Well, welcome, welcome, Saturday morning. And those of you who weren't here last night are probably feeling a whole lot more chipper than those who were. But we really had a good time. That's what counts. A couple of short announcements before we begin. We have today in the ambassador room where we have our hospitality things at night, we have a vendor there today who has some T-shirts that we've worked out a deal with them to come and sell. They're selling them for themselves. It's nothing for the foundation, but it's we had quite a few people ask us if they could come and sell these shirts. It's the coffee people in town. They're the ones who evidently had some image of Moroni on one of their T-shirts, and the church, you know, pretty much, as they're known for, put a lot of pressure on them. And they have some other things, so they'll be in there all day long, so take a peek at what they have. And I just wanted to let you know that they are going to be in there till probably about 7 o'clock tonight. Wanted to remind you, too, I didn't say anything last night about we always have a raffle here, and we'll be selling tickets all day today and into the evening. And what we're going to be raffling are the 3 embroidered blankets, if any of you haven't seen them, they're really quite nice, and 5 copies of our new DVD. So we'll talk to you more about that during the day. And we've moved the book table out into the foyer so it's more readily available and visible, and the authors are here whose books are there, and they will be selling them directly. I don't know if they're all in here. Ed, are you in here? Okay, that's Ed Bliss. He has his book out there. And Dwayne Anderson, he brought his book. And refresh. Oh, and ours' book is out there. Is there one more? Forgot to write him down. Anyway, look at, we'll have him stand up later in the day to remind you. We are very, very, very pleased to have Brian Patrick with us this morning to show his documentary. He came about 4 years ago and showed it when it was really quite brand new, and the Mountain Meadows Massacre story was kind of just beginning to raise its, you know, ugly little head again. And we've seen a lot in the last few years publicity about it. When I was growing up, it was like this distant little whisper, you know, negative, ugly little thing in the history of the church, which was never talked about, and I really didn't know much about it until quite later in my life. But Brian has taken this film, you know, many, many places in the country, and I got on different websites and read he's received a lot of awards for this film. But I want to read you a little bit of a bio that he gave me, and I would like to remind you that the biographies for all of our presenters are in the program, and we do that purposely so that we can save some time. I know at a lot of symposiums they have a formal introduction of every speaker, but we've just decided over the years that we'd rather put that in print and save quite a bit of time during the day. He has been directing award-winning documentaries for over 30 years, which surprised me. 3 films that he has directed, produced, and edited have aired on National Public Television, including Testimony, On Their Honor, and The Hideout. You might want to tell us what those are about when you get up here. Patrick has collaborated with directors such as Steven Spielberg, interviewing survivors of the Holocaust for the Shoah Foundation. He holds a Master of Fine Arts degree from Ohio University School of Film and has taught film video production at 5 universities. During this time, he developed and taught courses in film, video production, film history survey, in the documentary, experimental, and animation fields, and film directing. He has been teaching at the University of Utah since 1978, and he, as I said, completed this film, I think, about 5 years ago or 6 years ago. Yeah. And it's been shown a lot and always receives rave reviews. So I'm very pleased to introduce Brian.
Oh, thank you very much. It's such a pleasure to be here, and I see a lot of familiar faces, and I hope you won't be bored by seeing the film one more time. But it's always a, wonderful thing and a pleasure to show it. I'm very honored to be here at the Ex-Mormon Conference again, to be invited here again, because I just enjoy chatting with a lot of you folks. You do have a very unique, I think, conference going on here and organization. Just a couple of things is, I'm not Mormon at all. I'm from Ohio, just a young man from Ohio, came out here west and been teaching at the university, teaching filmmaking. And, I'm not any religious affiliation. And, for me, religion is just fine for everybody else. And as long as they don't impose their, their religious values on me and everybody else in a forceful manner, then that's fine too. But unfortunately, we know that it's just the opposite, that everybody loves to claim that their church is the only church, and in doing so, there becomes the rub and becomes like difficult for everybody else to live with. Anyhow, that being said, it's a wonderful thing to be here. Let me tell you, this film, just as Sue said, I've taken a lot of places, and a lot of places I think some of you have been at. But one of the most incredible times we showed the film was last June at the George Adair reunion down in Pine Valley, which is right near the Meadows. And this is a reunion of the ancestors or descendants of George Adair, who was one of the killers in this event. And this must have been a very bitter pill for that reunion party to swallow, to show this film to them. About 100 people in a room, and I'll tell you, that air was so thick you could carve it with a knife. But they really were a very gracious group, and we had a wonderful time afterwards discussing the whole thing. And I just wanted to tell you about that, because it's one of the many, unique adventures I've had with showing this movie all over the country. And I've made several documentaries, and none has been more, I think, important than this one. And probably influenced my life more than anything, and one that I've sort of like attached myself to more than anything. And I just feel very happy to be part of this. One of the things too is that being able to get inside the homes of people who ancestors were part of this on both sides has been, really amazing. And of course, the reason why I got into this whole film in the first place was that I never thought I would ever make a film about the Mountain Meadows Massacre. But I saw this article in the Salt Lake Tribune back in 1998. I mean, geez, it's almost been 10 years now. It was on a Sunday paper about how these two groups of descendants had come together from the massacre and formed this Mountain Meadows Association, and bent on forgiveness and reconciliation and healing. And I thought to myself, now there is really a unique sort of idea or angle to be able to tell this story, because here were real live people, not people that this event happened 100 almost 150 years ago, but real live people I could talk to that were struggling with trying to figure this thing out still. And the fact that they were actually joining hands and, trying to, get to know each other and learn about each other's personal struggle, I thought that was really a very, very important thing. Because I see so many, groups in this world, like the Irish Protestants and Catholics, and then you have the Palestinians, and look what we've done in Iraq now. The Shiites and Sunni Muslims, and I mean all these warring groups, particularly religious groups that that can't seem to come together because of this age-old strife, that's happened in the past. And anyhow, this was one situation where I thought this was unique. that these groups actually did try to come together and shake hands and try to put this behind them. Now, I think one of the things the film shows to me, you know, is that this is a very, very difficult concept, you know. Very difficult concept, because it becomes a clash of cultures, and not just religion, but culture. Anyhow, I'll let you figure it out for yourself, and I really appreciate you being you inviting myself, and Jennifer Van Enenum is here. She's the one handing out the little flyers, and she's, by the way, the voice of the little girl who survives the massacre in the film, and had a lot to do with you know, the post-production editing of the film. So anyhow, we'll talk to you later after the movie. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Can you turn the lights off? Yeah.
Any questions at all? I just wanted to say one thing that's probably on a lot of your minds, and that is the so-called formal apology that was just delivered last month by Henry Eyring. And some people asked me about that several times, like news people and everything, and I thought it was very strange. First of all, we were down at the Meadows that weekend just before that, and we showed the film down there. And it was really remarkable sort of screening about this many people, maybe more, and the descendants from both sides, from Arkansas and also from Utah, were there. And it's quite an emotional question and answer session afterwards. And then on September 11th, I guess they gave this so-called apology. But I will tell you, I talked to a lot of the Arkansas people that were there beforehand, and they really wanted to have something happen. They really wanted, you know, President Hinckley to come forth and be there. And even the man who was supposed to be there, I think it was Monson, I'm not sure. Anyhow, all of a sudden he got sick and he couldn't attend, and then Henry Eyring turns up, who was sort of a middle management sort of man, and then he issues this sort of, like, you know, profound regret statement, which immediately is interpreted by the fellow who took Glenn Leonard's place, as a church historian, Richard Turley. And, it's like, oh, this is an apology. Here it is. This is what you're waiting for. And this is the official apology. And I thought, oh, boy, I don't know if they're going to buy this, because I'm sure not. Because really, the man who really started this, this whole sort of reconciliation and healing process, who rebuilt this whole monument, was President Gordon B. Hinckley. He's the one who even makes this disclaimer that, by the way, we had nothing to do with it. And, I think that this apology needed to come from him and him alone. And to say that this is, the official apology and everybody's going to buy into this is ludicrous. I mean, Burr Fancher says right at the very end, he says, what we want is a formal apology, and we want, the church to acknowledge some responsibility. And really what they did was they just simply, allowed the Cedar City group to accept, the fact that they were solely responsible for this, And I just, just the whole thing seemed very ludicrous to me. And, I think the apology needs to come from him. And it's funny, it's like when we showed the film on September 11th at the Tower Theater here in town, some Mormon people were there, and they said, well, but he's 98 years old, and he's, probably couldn't make it. But the very next day, he was at Brigham Young accepting an award. So, and he's been all around the country, dedicating new temples and, since then. So, I don't know. What is the problem, I ask myself. And I think, well, here's a guy that's close to 100 years old. He's really the old guard. He's really from another era where, this blame was laid on these Arkansas people. They caused this. They brought it upon themselves. They came through here in a belligerent manner. And, all those women and children deserved, what they had coming. And, they're just that old guard, just not going to give that up. Sorry to say, to those Arkansas people. Anyhow. Anyhow, with that, I just wanted to open it up. There was a question back here right away. Yes, sir.
Just a reminder, please watch for Kathleen. Please watch for Kathleen to come to you with a microphone so that you can get recorded with your question.
Just wondering about distribution. Is your excellent film available at the local rental centers? And if not, when?
Yeah, it's not available at Blockbuster. We have it, basically I just sell it over the internet. It's in the libraries here in town and so forth. We are selling copies here, of course, signed copies here if you're interested at a reduced rate. So if you're interested, that'll happen afterwards. Yes? The Lighthouse Ministry also sells copies here in town. That's near the stadium, and they sell it over their website as well. They're a very good group of people.
Before I take another question, don't ask your question without the mic. We want it recorded, so we can't hear you.
I was just wondering what kind of progress is being made. It said at the end in the credits that they're working to try to get some federal control over the monument or some more fair ownership. Just wondering the status on that, if you know.
Would you repeat that, please?
Oh, was that too quiet?
No, I'm sorry. I wasn't paying attention.
Oh. Happens to me all the time. As far as the ownership and control of the monument, it's now in the hands of the church. It looked in the credits like it was saying that they're trying to get ownership in a more neutral party. I was wondering the status on that.
Right. I'm glad you brought that up. there's been a lot of activity down there at the Meadows that the church has, you know, bought up a number of parcels of land, particularly from Clive Burgess. I don't know, he's the man on the tractor, and whose, you know, ancestors, you know, had three of the children and so forth. You know, it's interesting why they want his parcel of land so desperately, and I think, I really think it's because of the movie. You know, it's like there all of a sudden it's like that is like earmarked as something. You know, those rocks on the ground mean something, and they are very, very driven to own all that property that, you know, includes that history. I mean, because when you own the property, you own the history of that, I think, in their mind. I mean, you know, having just been down there last month, and that, you know, that monument was put up in 1999, and there still is really nothing down there at that monument that explains anything except that one sign that I keep on showing in the movie. I mean, I just don't understand, and I guess it really is very clear that, you know, they do not want to have any, you know, historical interpretation there in the slightest. And, you know, what a great thing. I mean, what if, you know, and a lot of times I like sort of compare this to the Holocaust. You know, there's a lot of similarities there. You know, what if we went to Germany and we visited Auschwitz and Dachau, and there was no interpretation there because the Germans wouldn't allow that? I mean, that would be very strange, but it's the same thing to me. Back there, way back there, and the man with...
Wait a minute, I got a mic right here.
Okay, sorry.
I thought I'd take an opportunity since I was sitting next to the mic. Recently, I borrowed a copy of the Ensign from my brother-in-law and read the Mormon accounting of the massacre and had wondered if you'd had an opportunity to read that. It was the latest edition of the Ensign.
Yes, I have. It's like they. This is Richard Turley's account. Yes, actually, that showed up in my mailbox one day. I don't even know how they got my address, but anyway, they know. I'm sure. You know, It's kind of a plain and simple. I mean, it seems to like put the blame on the Cedar City people, that this is a renegade operation, and that they are responsible, and but they did give up some things, and that was the idea that, you know, that the, you know, the poison spring, and that was, you know, by the after all these years, that was, we've realized that that was probably a myth, you know, brought it, you know, conjured up by the people who did this, you know, to kind of to justify their crime. But I don't know. It didn't seem like it was, you know, quote, anything new that was really coming from the church, and it just seemed like the same old statement. Because, you know, back, I mean, it's funny. I completed this really with the DVD in 2004, and that little thing at the end. About the churches coming out with their version of the events. And they were saying, really, that they were going to come out with new material, but they really didn't come out with any new material. In fact, they really haven't really come out with it yet. And it's been a long time, and I'm wondering why they're taking so long. But anyway, I mean, you know, just sort of sending out press releases about it.
I had a question about the, you know, if a Brigham Young University made any replicas of the skulls or the bones that are in existence still, did they make any casts of the Marian
King? As far as I know, the only pictures of the bones are really what you saw here today. And I've been, you know, sought after, besieged, you know, like by a number of different groups. The History Channel, I sent a copy to them, and you know, to hope to get it broadcast, and all they did was basically take the idea of the movie and have it redone. Helen Whitney from WGBH, I sent a copy to WGBH in 2003. It was an early copy, and never heard from them, and all of a sudden she called me up and wanted, you know, pictures of the bones. She wanted, you know, all this stuff, and he wanted to pay me like $10,000, and
I just wouldn't sell it to them. For one thing, is that I told those Arkansas folks that, you know, I just wasn't going to sell this stuff around. You know, that I had, you know, I really appreciated their respect and that I was not going to, you know, sell this, you know, and so I do respect that to them. But, you know, the whole Brigham Young, you know, it's taking the bones of Brigham Young, I thought was, you know, isn't that a kind of ironic twist of the whole thing? Yes. Where's the mic?
Right here. I have a question. When I show this to my kids, there's lots of lessons, I think, that I'd like them to understand. Obviously,
sure.
The honesty, forgiveness, things like that. But one thing that kind of stood out to me was when the people down in Cedar City or whatever going to help redo the monument, and there was one statement in there, I don't know if I'm taking it out of context, but they said, as soon as President Hinckley gave permission for this to happen, then the community came out and did all of this. That's what I got out of
yes.
it. And it kind of seemed, for me, the lesson I'd like my kids to get out of it is you don't wait for someone else to tell you what's right. You do it ahead of time, and you don't let someone else persuade you to do something wrong. You take the individual responsibility for it.
Yeah. Well,
the question is, do you get the sense that the families who are joining with the victims' descendants, that they themselves have come up to the families and said, I apologize for what my descendants, because the Lee family in the video seemed very proud of their, I didn't get any sense that they were like, he was a great man, but he did this awful thing. It was still, he's a great man. So,
right.
I mean, what's the sense?
I don't know if anybody was at the Tower Theater September 11th here in town when I showed the film, but it was that same day earlier in the day that there was sort of this apology from Henry Eyring, and we sort of had the same discussion after the movie, and all of a sudden this elderly gentleman stood up and said, I'm the great-great-grandson of Isaac B. Haight, and I apologize profusely for what's going down here. And I thought that was... And then another man stood up, and, you know, he was from another, you know, descendant of the killers. And the same thing really happened when we were at the George Adair family in Pine Valley. That reunion, a number of people... we went out to the meadows with them, and they issued like these apologies, which I taped and everything. And I think there is an immense amount of outpouring from these people down there that have had to live with this. And I think that little scene in there where they, you know, they break apart the monument and the little kids and everything, that to me that's one of the most touching parts of the whole story. Because I think those people really have had to live with this, you know, on a personal level. I mean, can you imagine even the Lee family? And I don't know if there's any descendants of the Lees here. Are there? I bet you there are. Because there's a lot of them out there. He had 17 wives, I believe. Those people, I mean, can you imagine their ancestor was, you know, the only one convicted and executed, and then he was excommunicated and was ostracized, and all those people have had to deal with that, you know. And they're kind of like in limbo, you know, and you probably know more about that than I do.
Yes. Hi. Two parts. Can you elaborate a little bit on the event in Arkansas with Elder Pratt? And second, have any, it's Paiute Indians that were
Paiutes.
Part of it. Is there any historical documentation from Paiutes talking about the incident?
I did videotape an old man. In fact, he was part of, you know, and this was down in the Cedar City area, and I can't think of his name, but... It just didn't work out. I really could not get anybody that had any, you know. I mean, they had sort of an oral history there, and his statement was is that we didn't have anything to do with it. I didn't quite buy that, and so I just left it out rather than confuse the whole movie. Because it almost, you have to go into that very, very deeply. And I think that we do have a historical record that, you know, the Paiute Indians were involved. How much or, you know, how little, you know, is debatable, but they were involved as far as I can, my research has shown. And about Parley P. Pratt, about that, that's the gravesite in Arkansas where Ron Loving and Vern Lee are, you know, first shown, you know, at the park bench there. That's a gravesite of Parley P. Pratt, and he was murdered by a man, a disgruntled husband who, you know, was incensed that his wife had run off with Parley P. Pratt. You're right. And so I guess there was a trial in which Pratt was exonerated, and then but this man followed him and murdered him on the highway. Yes, sir.
Is that working?
Yes, yeah. We have a
the Fancher Baker relatives.
Yes.
Are probably concerning that the church probably is worried about them asking for a monetary remuneration, and that's possibly the reason they don't want to come out and make an apology. Is there any evidence of this?
That's a very good question, sir. I know these Arkansas people very, very deeply, and there's never been any mention of that. In fact, they're offended. You know, the thought that that's what they're looking for. And, President Hinckley started this whole sort of process and event, rebuilding this monument and extending this, you know, this hand of, I mean, in his own words, reconciliation. And these people came forth and, you know, like in good faith. And I don't think there was any sort of talk about having any sort of, you know, monetary remuneration at all, ever. And, I really think that they, you know, someone explained to me once that said they don't want to, you know, go down that path, meaning they, the church. It's a slippery slope, they've told me, you know. That once they start denying this, or once they say, okay, we made a mistake here, then it's like then it opens the book to like a lot of other questions that are in the church as well. And I don't know. I mean, this doesn't have anything to do with the origins of the Mormon faith. This is just simply about, you know, people being attacked and murdered, you know, 150 years ago. And I think, you know, it'd be a very simple thing for them to apologize. And I don't know. Bill and I were talking, you know, earlier. Why can't they do it? Why can't they really just do it instead of this sort of, you know, blue smoke and mirrors, which goes on? And I don't understand. I think it goes back to maybe President Hinckley is just really, you know, he's adamant that he can't do it. You know, can't really do it. Yes. Two more questions? Okay.
Okay. I'm a direct descendant of George Washington Adair, which you just mentioned.
Yeah.
And I do know of a written account by him of a number of sexual assaults that took place. Is there a reason that you chose not to include this in your film?
With George Washington Adair?
Yes.
There's a lot of history here. There's a lot of people involved with, you know, this massacre. I made this on a shoestring budget, I have to tell you. You know, I got a little $5,000 grant from the University of Utah. you know, it's pretty much by myself. I didn't have like an army of people to like go out and find everybody, you know, and make a, you know, some big PBS documentary. Glad I didn't, you know. But, you know, I just, there's a lot of people that were involved on all the sides, you know, that I just really didn't get to or get involved with. You know, basically the people that sort of came to me, came forth to me that I was able to find, you know, that's, you know, who were, that's what's included in the movie. And it's funny, it's like after the film was made, a lot of people came, kind of came out of the woodwork and said, oh, you know, you didn't talk to me, you know, and so forth. And especially people, you know, when I started making this film, it's like the people from Arkansas were all very, very hopeful and almost sort of but tight-lipped at the same time about this, like, reconciliation process. You know, the church was rebuilding this monument. This was going to be a good thing. This was going to be healing, and this was going to be something that they could finally kind of, like, feel good about, you know? I mean, because look at the hate, you know, in those monuments that's back in Harrison, Arkansas, you know. We, you know, vengeance is mine. I will repay. I mean, you know, they hated Mormons back there. And so this was something that was, you know, a very good thing. And anyhow, they, those people, you know, wanted this to really happen. And when I started actually recording them, and they're very tight-lipped about, you know, saying anything negative about the whole thing. It was the Fanchers, Burr Fancher and Scott Fancher, that came forth and said, "Hey, you know, we don't quite buy into all this, you know." And you can see that they still like harbor those grudges. You know, they won't let it go. But then afterwards, like a lot of people came out of the woodwork and said, "Oh, well, we wanted to say something too." But the fact is, we were on there with the cameras all the time, and no one really wanted to say anything. And it was very hard to get people other than the Lee family to really come out and say, you know, what they really felt. Yes, sir.
My name is Gene Olmsted. I'm not a Mormon, or naturally not an ex-Mormon, but I was at the 150th anniversary.
Yes.
down there, and I was privileged to attend one of the Fancher family meetings that they had. And I don't know, maybe you, somebody said this, but what they are trying to do now is to get the site made a national historical site, so
right.
as to preserve what has right. happened there and preserve any monuments or anything. Because the original rock cairn that Major Carlton put up there way back in 1859 had a cross on it.
Right.
And the Mormons will not allow them to put a cross on the
right.
one that's there now.
Right. Well, like I say, there's a lot of activity down there. They're developing the area around the meadows. They're, you know, homes are like, you know, coming up, and that one the Rock Cairn actually was where Clive Burgess, you know, with his tractor. That's where that was. They really want to own all that property, and I think that you know, it's a strange thing. I really, these people from the Burr and Scott Fancher, their group, they really want to have that as a national monument, and it should be. Yeah. You know, we should, you know, the American people, not the Mormon Church, should own that property, and so that all people can see what, you know, that what happened there. It's part of our Western heritage and American heritage. I mean, it's not for anybody to own and to kind of interpret, you know, or not interpret.
Well, they're afraid that maybe a couple of generations go by and people kind of maybe forget that all of a sudden it'll start to disappear again like it has in the past, anything there on the site.
What disappeared? Oh, the monument?
Yeah, the monument.
Oh,
yeah.
I don't think... Oh, I see. Well, yeah, I think the church was saying, you know, this is a place that we can maintain and you know, and they have. It's nice. They've got... it looks very nice down there, and I have to admit... I have to say this, though, that when I first started making the movie in 1998, and I went down to the meadows, and I first saw that old cairn, you know, in that field. That's why I made the movie. I mean, isn't that a spooky place? I mean, and to see it kind of now as a sort of, you know, I don't know, it's kind of like all washed and clean and, you know, it's something in the history is gone. I mean, even that place had that plaque, you know, the Mountain Meadows Massacre and John D. Lee did it and everything. You know, that was the first thing they got rid of. And I thought that was pretty telling.
Thank you so much, Brian. I'm sorry we've got to stop.
Yeah, we have to stop. Okay. Thank you. I thank you very much. I love showing it to your group. I have to say, like, watching this and hearing you, like, chuckle or like, laugh out loud at some of the places which a lot of people, you know, it sort of goes over their head, you know. But you kind of, like, responded perfectly to all the things that I laughed at myself when I was editing this thing in that little room. You know, thank you very much. But, so, you know, some people, I remember I was at this film festival in Santa Fe, and this man says, you know, this is a subversive film. And I said, you know, that's the best compliment anybody's ever given me. But, anyhow, we do have some DVDs for sale, and I'd be glad to sign them if you like outside here. Thank you very much, everybody. Good luck to you.
We're going to take a very short break. I gave Bob McHugh extra time on this schedule, and now we've already grabbed 15 minutes of it. So please take a short break, 5 minutes, and we're going to start.
Hey folks, if you could take your seats, I think we're going to get started. Who can whistle real loud? Thank you. So as was indicated, we have a little projection problem. And so what we're going to do is we're just going to gather around my slides here, and we'll see what we can do. So while they make an effort, can you hear me okay like that? While we work on this little technical difficulty, I'll start, and then we'll hopefully we'll be able to catch up with some of the slides. As I've got some beautiful graphics that I hope I'm going to be able to share with you. Is Brian still here, perchance? Yes. Brian, I'm relatively familiar with the history of Mountain Meadows, but I've got to tell you that I felt like I was being kicked in the stomach during your documentary. That had a profound impact on me, and I'm amazed that with $5,000 you could do something so remarkable. So thank you very much. And I was struck by two ironies. Up? Okay. I was struck by two ironies during that film. And the first was that the ideological belief in innocent blood prevented children from dying, and also preserved the best evidence of the crime. And secondly, I was struck by something I read just a little while ago, that in order for evil on a large scale to be committed, it takes two things. The first is high self-esteem, and the second is strong moral beliefs, strong ideological beliefs. You have to have high enough self-esteem that you're prepared to impose your will on others, and the moral beliefs are required to allow you to justify violence against other people. And that is a common denominator across most of what we regard as humanity's worst disasters, and you told that story beautifully. It couldn't have been told better. And we're now going to move on to the hopefully more happy topic of marriage on the way out of Mormonism. Speaking of serial disasters. But first of all, I wanted to mention that I'm here courtesy of a miracle. I'm dead serious about this. I came down with a computer-related repetitive strain injury in my right arm a few months ago. Why are you laughing? I won't take the time to tell the story, but it really had nothing to do with typing stuff about Mormonism. It had to do with mousing, of all things, related to my work. But this injury came upon me right when I stopped posting at RFM. Back in May, I moved to a new law firm for the first time in over 10 years and started a new job and was very busy, and my RFM posting went down to just about zero. I immediately developed this repetitive strain problem. And the notes that you're going to hopefully see later here today, all 300-some-odd slides, were that material was gathered a long time ago, so I didn't have to type it. And I was not going to be able to organize it for this presentation. I've been working about quarter time for the past 4 months and trying to rehabilitate my arm. And I'm not joking, this is all dead serious. Last Saturday, my arm began to recover. Right? So the higher power punished me for stopping posting at RFM. Right? And if this isn't a clear message, right, when at the last minute I was given the strength of my arm back, right? So now we're talking about patterns. Those are all true facts.
Hallelujah.
Hallelujah, thank you. If I believed in a certain type of higher power, I've got enough facts there to find a pattern to support my beliefs. Now, I happen to believe that the new doctor I started seeing a month ago and the new therapies that he prescribed probably are what... fortunately for me, I'm going to be able to start working the way I like to work again in a short time. But what we're going to talk about today is pattern finding. There's an enormous amount of data out there with regard to our intimate relationships. The more emotional we are about data, the more difficult it is for us to interpret it properly. And so it's no surprise that with regard to religion and intimate relationships, that sort of thing, we see pretty much what we need to see and what we want to see. And so what I'm going to strongly recommend, I'm going to say this half a dozen times at least, we former Mormons need to get over our phobia with regard to professional counselors. And we need to stop being so cheap. Yeah. Professional counselors are worth their weight in gold when it comes to intimate relationships. And I don't know any around here, but what I would strongly encourage is that for those who lead the ex-Mormon community in each of the various places around the U.S. and in Canada, to identify good family therapists, good therapists who deal with spiritual transitions, because there are lots of them. And that we make that data available, and that we strongly recommend that our loved ones who are stumbling out of the Mormon cloister one after another seek that kind of professional guidance. It's tremendously important. And it's the objective observers, or relatively objective observers, that are able to help us see the data in a realistic way. A lot of the people who work in this field talk about the difference between the inside perspective and the outside perspective. The inside is our subjective perspective, and it's colored by all kinds of things, and I'm not going to be able to get to as many as I would like, but we'll talk about some of the consistent mistakes, thinking mistakes that we make, and how those apply to intimate relationships. A therapist, a good therapist, well-grounded in the empirical work related to relationships, has a different perspective. He sees hundreds of people with these problems. He sees patterns that we can't possibly see. And relying upon his advice and even consciously pushing some of our own buttons, like the authority bias. Mormonism and other religions exploit the authority bias. Madison Avenue exploits the authority bias all the time. we can exploit the authority bias by choosing a therapist that has authority. Like, you have to make a good choice. You don't want to just, because we have these buttons. They're there. Once I've committed myself to a particular therapeutic approach, I've bought into the authority of the scholars who develop the approach and the therapist who wields it. I am allowing myself to be influenced. I am choosing to be influenced in a particular way. Like, we're subject to these influences. We may as well choose to a much greater extent how we're influenced by them. So we're going to talk about basically four things. First, we're going to review some of the literature with regard to what makes us happy, and in particular how adversity fits into the happiness picture. If you're sitting here, you've had some recent experience with adversity. I think I can assume that. And then why we are so poor at making choices, some of these consistent dysfunctional thinking patterns that we all have. And then next, how does all of this relate to marriage and divorce in general? And lastly, how does the post-Mormon marriage thing, divorce thing, how is that different from ordinary marriage and divorce issues? You just missed a beautiful slide. I hope we can come back to it. Now, everything that I'm going to say is grounded in empirical social scientific research. I've got a list of books that I found helpful that will be on one of the slides. But this is science, and that means it's not dogma. That means what I'm telling you is the considered opinion of some of the best people in the field, and all of them say, hey, this is just the best we can do. We might be wrong, right? This is an evolving, growing thing. It's not the last word, and I'm not going to say that after every sentence, but it's there after every sentence. This is just the best we can do to find our way along. And that's all we're doing here, folks. We're exploring an amazing, wonderful landscape of human experience. I've got the Wile E. Coyote going off the cliff here on a slide that we're just passing by. One of the ideas that I found really intriguing is the idea of a personal mythology. Now, mythology, Mormonism is a mythology. Religions are mythologies. We sometimes refer to everybody else's religion as mythology, and our religion is truth. That's a very common concept. But the fact of the matter is that we all have beliefs that are so basic that we don't think of them as beliefs. We think of them as just what is. The most unquestioned, fundamental beliefs we have are never questioned. Those are our mythologies. Now, science is a kind of mythology, except science has the belief built into it that it can change and that it should change. What we're going to talk about today, what I'm going to propose to you, is a belief with regard to relationships, a relationship mythology. Now, I happen to believe that this is true. What I'm going to tell you, I really believe, is it's my best guess at reality, given all of the reading that I've done. Now, this isn't deep philosophy. This is just based on some science and observations of my own life. And I've got nothing against philosophy. By the way, I read something just the other day, actually, that resonated with me from a philosopher. He said, getting married in order to have sex is like buying a 747 for the free peanuts. Now that philosopher's name is Jeff Foxworthy. So I've got nothing against philosophy. So, but before we get into this relationship mythology that I want to talk about, I want to very quickly outline three of the most powerful myths of all time. And then we're going to outline those quickly now and come back to them at the very end. These are stories that are memorable. They're much more memorable than the long, convoluted story I'm going to tell you about relationships. So we're going to use these three memorable stories as hooks to hang some of the ideas that I hope you'll take away from this on. The first is Icarus. Icarus is the, I can't remember his father's name, was it Daedalus? He and the father were trapped by a foreign king, and in order to escape, the father built wings. This is a Greek myth. Built wings, and a set for the father and a set for the son. And the father was concerned that the son might fly too high, because the wings were made out of wax, birds' feathers that they had collected, and wax. And if he flew too high and too close to the sun, the wings would perhaps melt, and so the father counseled his son not to fly too high. Well, the son took off, and in the euphoria of his newfound power, his newfound freedom, he rejected his father's advice. He flew too high, and he fell to his death. I've got some lovely slides showing this. Believe me. Now, Icarus has been interpreted as an indication of the human hubris, that we all overstep our bounds, and that we are doomed to fail. It's interpreted in a variety of other ways as well. Have you heard of Lawn Chair Man? Yeah. He attached a bunch of weather balloons to a lawn chair, and had himself anchored, a six-pack of beer and a BB gun, and his theory was that he was just going to cut the ropes and float up a little ways, drink his beer, and come back down by shooting the BB gun and popping a few of the balloons to bring himself back down. Well, he cut the ropes, went to over 15,000 feet. And interfered with planes trying to land at LAX. He eventually did get down, indeed by shooting his own balloons, and became entangled in a wire of some sort. He wasn't killed. There you go. I mean, he knew that balloons had a certain ability to lift. He hadn't, calculated the physics too carefully. And kabam, you're at 15,000 feet playing chicken with 747s. So, I mean, Icarus, you can find all kinds of Icaruses around. Now, Sisyphus. Sisyphus was a king, and he was a really smart, creative guy. He invented navigation devices. He was clever beyond belief. He was also ruthless and unethical. He used to rob travelers who came to stay with him. Even he would kill people. And eventually he was punished by the gods. And it's a long, very interesting story. I'll just tell you the conclusion. His punishment was to forever push a rock up to almost the top of a hill, whereupon he would lose the ability to push or hold. The rock would roll back down to the bottom of the hill, and he would return and be forced again to push that rock up the hill. There are analogies to doing home teaching, someone just said up here. Thank you, Jared. I agree with that. There are lots of analogies to lots of other things. Some people have said that this story is about modern life. We've lost our meaning. Sisyphus was disconnected from the meanings within his culture. He could no longer aspire to do the things that men and gods aspired to do. He was stuck in a mundane little rat race, as some would say all human beings are. I think there's a lot more to the story than that. The pursuit of power, money, knowledge, sex, love, these have all been compared to Sisyphus. Everything that moth or dust doth corrupt. The essential futility of life. I think there's more to the story, but just keep that in mind. Icarus, power, overstepping, Sisyphus, loss of meaning, condemned to do the same damn thing over and over again. The Holy Grail is the last one, and I'm not talking about Monty Python, although that is an absolutely brilliant movie. So the Holy Grail, the myth is told in many ways. This is the chalice that held the blood of Christ in the earlier tellings of the myth. And heroes throughout many epics of time sought the Grail on epic adventures. And during the course of... they never found the Grail, right? But they went on these massive epic adventures to find the Grail, during the course of which they would encounter vicissitudes and trials of various kinds, and they would be restructured, they would be reformed by the adventure itself, but they would always return without the Grail. So those are the three stories I want you to just sort of store away in the back of your mind. Icarus, Sisyphus, and the Holy Grail. Now here's my relationship myth. We need to talk a little bit about where relationships come from, the evolutionary biology of human relationships. Why is it that men and women try to live together, by the way? Have you ever wondered about that? It's not a good fit. Not that men and men are a better fit or that women are women. It's just not, it's a tough fit. Well, apparently, and there are probably scientists here who know this stuff better than I can. They can correct me after if they'd like. The thing is that babies have big heads because they have big brains. And there's a little problem with the female architecture. The brain can't form in the womb. The kid's got to be born half-baked. And the baking doesn't finish until the kid's around 25. Does that make sense? Given what you know about kids who are, say, 18 to 20 years old? So, literally, the brain is still wiring itself in fundamental ways up to about age 25. One of the last things to get wired is long-term consequences. Thinking through long logical chains toward, if I take the car without telling mom and dad and drive to Vegas tonight, you know, where does that lead, right? Your average 18-year-old is not equipped to do that kind of thinking. So now that, as it turns out, is a really good thing, because when a baby is born, its brain is still plastic, and so the brain formats to a large extent against the environment. A baby born in an ice age is going to format neurally in a way that's radically different from a baby born in an equatorial jungle. Completely different wiring in a lot of basic ways. That's what gives human beings their incredible adaptability. That's why we've survived. So this is a good thing, that the brains are big and the female architecture can't let the head get properly baked while it's inside, and so it has to keep baking for 25 years on the outside. Well, women, as it turns out, can't supply enough calories to keep them and their babies alive, right? So if the father is prepared to hang around and take care of the babies and provide calories, the babies live. And the genes of that father pass to the next generation. If the father buggers off, the babies die. Now you can see how evolution takes care of these things. The fathers who were inclined to hang around had children who survived, who had the genes of those fathers. And the fathers who took off eliminated themselves from the gene pool. Kind of like the guy with the lawn chair, right? Guys like that probably get eliminated from the gene pool. Well, so do guys who don't hang around and take care of the babies. So this is a, you know, basic necessity is driving this. So there's this, you know, this partnership that has been forced together by evolutionary pressures, but it's never been a particularly comfortable partnership. Well, women don't need the help of men to generate those calories anymore. The force of necessity that was holding male and female together relaxed. Now, there's another profoundly important aspect of human psychology. We crave novelty. We crave new things. That is why humans are so inventive. We're continually restless and exploring. If you take a whole bunch of energy that was required to generate calories and hold relationships together and release it, which is exactly what's happened, then that energy, one of the places that energy is going to go is into exploring, the search for novelty. And so our relationships are competing against other sources of novelty. In cultures like the Mormon culture, there's an ideological necessity to remain together. Stay together and break up and you don't get to go to the celestial kingdom, where your wife then becomes one of thousands of sister wives, if you're really lucky. My great-grandmother was the fourth wife of a powerful Mormon man, and I've read her journals. And irony of ironies, I exist because the prophet of the day told all the Mormon leaders to show the flag and take another wife in the late 1800s. When Mormons were beginning to rebel against polygamy, the 12 and the stake presidents and a few of the others all were told, go take another wife. And my grandfather reluctantly took wife number 4, who was my great-grandmother. And but for that unique genetic combination, I would not be standing here today. Her journals do not tell a pretty story. This was the kind of intimacy to which we all aspire, I presume, is not present. How could it be present in those polygamous relationships? Now, mind you, polygamy has been shown by economists to be a far more efficient, far more productive form of marriage than monogamy. If you take a group of 10 people and you've got 5 pairs, and you've got on the one side and on the other side you've got 1 man and 9 wives, are any of the women here surprised to hear that the 1 man and the 9 wives are a hell of a lot more productive than the 5 men and the 5 women? They do. The women do all the work, says this honest man sitting to my right. No, but I'm dead serious. 9 women and 1 man will outcompete, profoundly outcompete, 5 men and 5 women, right? So I view pair bonding, the opportunity for widespread pair bonding, as a luxury. It's a luxury good, folks, to be able to bond intimately, to face the challenge of bonding intimately with a woman or with another person. I don't want to exclude people who have same gender orientations here. Everything I'm saying basically applies to them as well as to heterosexual couples. I'll get out of the way here. So we're to the part of the story now where we know we've got men and women together in these relationships. We have these instincts to reproduce, and yet we're pulled by the desire for novelty and new experiences and whatnot. There's this tension is running in both directions. Now, how many people here would admit that their children have been... No, don't put up your hands. I shouldn't ask for that. Just think about this. How many people would admit that their children are, on balance, a greater source of sadness than happiness? Now, what the literature says, and this literature is compiled not on the basis of questionnaires. Questionnaires are misleading. The best social psychology stuff that I've found works on the basis of measuring physiological data, measuring stress responses within the body during experience, and on the basis of people who wear buzzers or cell phones and they're beeped numerous times throughout the day and they're asked, what are you doing right now? How are you feeling? So rather than relying upon memory or upon what you think you're going to feel if you do something, I caught you in the moment. You're at the football game ended 5 minutes ago and your team lost. How are you feeling right now? And as it turns out, what people say about what they're feeling right now and what their physiology says differs radically from what they say they remember feeling and from what they think they will feel. So the data with regard to children and parents says that there's highs and there's lows, right? If you're with your friends, it's sort of like this. With the kids, it's like this. Big swings, big valleys. We tend to remember the best parts and also the worst parts of relationships like that. But our instinct with regard to our children is such that we remember things in a positive way generally. The research indicates that marital satisfaction kind of goes like this. You're down here, you fall in love. Right? That lasts for about 6 months. And then you crash. And then maybe you decide to get married and it bumps along again in the right direction. And then you have a baby. It crashes. Right after you have that baby, your marital satisfaction crashes. That is the single largest divorce point within 2 years of the birth of the first child. And then it bumps along. It doesn't come back up until the child hits 13, and it drops again. And that's the second major divorce point, right there. And guess when it goes back up? And you'll be happy to hear that it does. Pardon me? When the last kid leaves. Not when a kid leaves. When the last kid leaves, marital and life satisfaction goes up dramatically. Now, I have 7 children, and I can tell you that that data is borne out precisely by my experience, and it's going to be a long time before the last one leaves. Could I imagine my life without them? Absolutely not, right? So, would I suggest people stop having children? Absolutely not. There's a very small minority choose not to have them. That's fine. Most people are going to have kids. We've got this huge instinct that compels us in that direction. What I will say is that it's really helpful to understand that you're going to go through hell probably in relationship terms for the first couple of years after that first baby is born. It turns you upside down. And that you should, you know, if we can expect, if we see a big, curvy, twisty road coming, well, we adjust. And we might even learn how to enjoy the curves. If we think we're on a highway and we're going to be continually frustrated as we, you know, bang into the guardrail and do all sorts of other kinds of damage. So it looks like we've got, are we working? Not quite yet. Okay. So we'll just keep going here. Now, one of the best books I've read ever is a book called The Happiness Hypothesis. And it, the author of that book is a social psychologist. And one of the images that he develops throughout that book that I have found to be profoundly helpful is the image of the rider on the elephant. Now, the rider is the recently evolved conscious mind. It's us. It's what we perceive to be us. The elephant is everything else. The elephant is about 50% genetic and 50% conditioning. But it's pretty solid. By the time you get to our age, even a lot younger than I am, it's pretty solid. That elephant is not going to change a whole lot. There are other aspects of personality that can change, your goals, your values and whatnot, but you've got your elephant, and that's pretty much it. The rider has this illusion that the rider is in control. And that means that when the elephant does something, the rider has to provide an explanation. The rider's kind of like your own lawyer, right? Who justifies, rationalizes, and explains all the crazy stuff you do and try to make you feel good about it. You can't trust the rider, quite frankly. And that's another reason that professional advice is really helpful when you're dealing with powerful emotional experiences like leaving Mormonism or marriage trauma. Because the professional advisor can say to you, you know what? You know, here's why you're saying this. This is the rider rationalizing something the elephant has done. People do this over and over again, and you ought to disregard your rider on this one. The rider is leading you astray. Now, the best way I have to bring that point home is to remind you of a lovely movie that most of you have probably watched called The Truman Show. Jim Carrey in one of his very best roles. Jim is a Canadian, by the way. And in that movie, I mean, we all relate to Carrey's character in that movie. He's been completely hoodwinked. A whole world, synthetic world, has been manufactured for the express purpose of hoodwinking him and having him provide entertainment to other people. Look, as the lights gradually come on for Carrey, so Carrey, if you think about the way he's been programmed, his elephant has been conditioned. So his genetics are what they are, but he grew up in a false, an utterly and completely false environment, and that imbued him with a whole bunch of instincts. Now, can you remember what some of those instincts are? How did Jim feel about water? Can anyone remember that? Afraid. Deathly afraid. Why was he deathly afraid of water? Because he believed that his father, he had been programmed with memories with regard to a boating accident in a storm, and his father had died, and these had been reinforced in a way that was calculated to screw him up completely with regard to water. He was terrified of it. And he lived on an island. right? And he was terrified of the bridge that left the island because it went over water. He had been programmed in such a way that he was not going to leave the island, right? Well, as he eventually begins to notice things, things are not right. He's uncomfortable with different things. He begins to get the sense that that fear of water was an untrustworthy instinct. This is the rider noticing something about the elephant and saying, I'm not sure if that's legitimate, right? So what does he do? At the moment of truth, he's in the car with his wife. He shuts his eyes because his instinct is so powerful, right? And he stamps his foot on top of her foot, which is on the accelerator, and forces her to steer across the bridge. They get past the bridge. A massive fire bursts out. He's terrified of fire as well. Shut the eyes, you blast through the fire. Eventually, he ends up in a ship, and he's sailing through this storm, and he's confronted that fear and put it aside. And the final moment is when the prow of the ship hits the shell that surrounds his world. He sailed into the sky. One of my friends has a recently returned missionary son who uses that metaphor to describe the collapse of his faith. The moment when he sailed, when he crashed into the sky, is the moment when his Mormon faith collapsed. So here we see the rider figuring stuff out and then beginning to question the elephant. And that's what we need to get better at doing. And again, professional advisors, academic literature, you know, books about how the mind works, that helps us to get in touch with when the rider's BSing us, when the rider is probably more trustworthy, when we should question the elephant. These are all very important aspects of our personal psychology that we are we ready? Okay. That's okay. Okay. Do you want to hit the slideshow? Or do I do it here?
Well, no, you have to do it from your laptop because the place that they brought us doesn't work with that dongle.
Okay, just a sec.
Is that a Canadian laptop?
It says Hewlett-Packard on it. Okay. Just hang on here. Matt, do I just click it? What do I do?
The dongle doesn't work with that projector.
Ah.
Because they had to replace it on a series.
Okay. Okay.
Sorry about that, Bob.
That's okay.
Would you like me to push the button for you?
Absolutely. Okay. Stand on. What, but go back one? I think that might be wrong. Yeah, that's the chair. Yeah, it's the... This is the wrong...
You go down here and...
We're going to very quickly flip through the pictures and then we'll get back to the text. So this is Salvador Dali's Geopolitical Child, which is one of my favorite images. I showed it last year. The man breaking, or the person breaking out of the world, a little bit like Truman sailing, crashing into the sky. Go to the next one. I sent an artist named Ryan Kittleson that image and asked him if he would do something for me. And this is what he did. So here we have drawers within drawers within drawers. A human being coming out of one drawer, emerging from another drawer. I'm not sure how well you can see this, but this is a head exploding. This is not entirely without trauma, this process of changing one's view. Look at the serenity on the face as the head reconstructs itself. And then here we have another drawer. And you won't be able to see the detail, but up on the wall there are other drawers with little figures looking out of them. Drawers within drawers within drawers. As human beings continue to emerge, continue to evolve. And the people who see this hanging in my office say, what's the chameleon there on the floor? That would be a white salamander. I just tell them that I think the chameleon probably has something to do with the guy emerging. I don't tell them about white salamanders. That's too long a story. Next slide. Okay, next one. Next. Stop there. Okay, we want to be practical, right? There are dangers with being too academic about things like relationships. Next slide. Okay, go back one slide. You'll see that's a list of books that are relevant to this topic and I think helpful. Next. Next, we're going to skip that. Okay, here we've got Icarus. Next. The sun exalting in his power. Next. The sun having a little problem with flight plan. Next. Lawn chairman. Next. Sisyphus. Now that looks fun, doesn't it? It does look a little bit like home teaching now that you mention it. Next. Next. Okay, not that Holy Grail, the other one. Next. 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 So this is, go back one. So this is the evolutionary story. Then one day he invented the wheel, and that's the last I've seen of him. Well, that's a little apropos to what we were talking about, that the necessity of being together has been relieved, folks. It's now a choice. We've got to find ways to make it work. Next. The happiness hypothesis. This is a gorgeous image. Look at this. Here's your elephant. You can barely see the rider up there swimming in a body of water. The body of water probably represents the social environment. It has currents that'll even take the elephant, right? Move the elephant all over the place. And that poor rider up there who thinks he's steering, right? It's really funny when you think about it. Next. Okay. We've covered a lot of this material now, so let's just flip through that. This is, I'll put these slides up on the internet as well as a much longer set. As I said, I had about 300 odd pages of slides, and I took about 70 or something and in the last couple of days organized them this way. Stop there. And so we'll put both sets up. For the people who want to read the full set of notes, they'll be there. I love this image. This is relevant to the Truman Show. Where does your world end, by the way? What defines the boundaries of your world? It's not reality, generally speaking. The boundaries of our worlds are defined by social constructs, beliefs about ourselves. Next slide. Oh, back. Forgot that quote. Man is... back or forward? Try going back. There we go. Clifford Geertz. Man is an animal suspended in webs of significance that he himself has spun. That is the matrix. The evil genius is a collective us. There is no evil cabal at the top of Mormonism or anywhere else. These things are produced by very large social forces. And we can, once we get past to the angry stage, there's no point, really. We realize, generally, there is no point in being angry. It's like, am I angry at the bear who ate my dog? I mean, bears do that. If the bear can get my dog, he's going to eat my dog. That is the nature of bears. I try and keep my dog away from bears. I build fences and take protective precautionary measures, but I don't get mad at the bear. It's the same thing with social organisms, such as the Mormon Church. Next. I'm going to skip that. Go to the next one. Okay, here are the studies that show marital satisfaction relative to kids. We've already talked about that. Next. Oh, you went one too many. Now that our last is off to college, why don't you tell me who the hell you are? it's funny because it's true. There is a fundamental reawakening that occurs, right, when the last kid leaves home, and that reawakening is more profound if the connection within the family is stronger. People who are not so tight don't go through the same kind of trauma. And as they say, people go to psychologists for two reasons. First, to get tightened up, and second, to get loosened up. You know, which are you? Well, most of us here probably need more loosening than tightening. And that certainly is the case at my house. Next. Let's leave it there. Now, let me just... So it's 11:45. What time am I ending? Okay. Okay, perfect. So now let's talk about choice. Let's talk about choice in relationships. We've got to choose to make this work. In the initial stages of a relationship, the 6 months of emotional cascade or hormonal cascade, where you're, they say that people shouldn't be allowed to commit to marriage during that six-month period for the same reason people shouldn't be allowed to drive while drunk. They're fundamentally impaired, and this is, you know, psychologists saying this, not just people writing about it. There's a cocoon that surrounds the couple, kind of like tops, spinning tops. Have you ever put tops inside one of those bowls, right, where the slope of the bowl is such that the tops just continually bounce off each other because the nature of the bowl pushes them down into the bottom together? Well, as the relationship matures and necessity in evolutionary terms, if we're looking at the long time frame, relieves, the floor flattens out and the tops end up gyrating in much larger circles and having less to do with each other. Next down. Next. And so we'll stop there just for a second. So the idea is that if you want the relationship to work, an ideology like Mormonism actually creates a bit of a basin there. You've got to stay together. You've got to do this. You've got to do that. And so that encourages people in some ways to work through their difficulties. Now, Mormon culture has lots of other problems that take people away from each other. I think the temple ceremony is an apt metaphor. The men go one way, the women go the other. And at the moment of the formation of the marriage, it's a three-party show, not a two-party show. It's the husband, the wife, and the institution making a three-way covenant. And going to bed with the church every night is tough, right? It just doesn't work that well. The intimacy is breached in all kinds of ways. So I'm not suggesting the Mormon model is a good one. I'm just pointing out that Mormonism has some forces that keep the tops rubbing up against each other, that you lose when you leave Mormonism. We need to find forces that will bring us together in that fashion again. Now, this picture is designed to represent biological evolution. Models like that one are used to study how species evolve against an environment. And there's something really helpful about this in terms of understanding how our relationships work. A species has a relationship, an animal has a relationship to the environment. If the environment is changing over time, which it always does, the animal has to change too. Otherwise, it'll become disconnected from its food sources and it'll die. If it changes too quickly, it'll die too for the same reason. It's become disconnected. And so what you see in biological evolution is a species will not be changing quickly enough and the environment will kind of move away from it. And that creates a crisis, some chaos. And then the species grows very quickly, evolves very quickly until it's reconnected to the environment. And then the process repeats itself. And so what we see, go to the next slide, is a pendulum swinging between a little bit too much order and a little bit too much chaos. This is called the edge of chaos. That's where life exists. Living things show this characteristic of going back and forth between order and chaos, riding a wave, as it were, that constitutes life. Now, relationships are a lot like that. There's a very good evidence that both large social group relationships and intimate relationships have this feature, that growth comes after chaos. So here's this little organism named Bob McHugh, who is comfortably, more or less, he thought, embedded in the Mormon environment. All of a sudden, the Mormon environment disappears. We are suspended in webs of our own spinning, as I just read. Well, all of a sudden, those webs come unspun. I'm in chaos. That throws my relationship with my wife into chaos. That was 6 years ago, and there's been an enormous amount of growth. And it's not been easy. I'm not going to say more than that. It's been tough. And we've both grown in ways that neither of us could possibly have imagined. Had we remained comfortably embedded, I can give you a 100% assurance that that growth would not have happened. My wife would not have spent 6 months in France last year with our three youngest children, learning how to cope with a new environment, giving them an international experience, et cetera, et cetera. That would have, there's just no way that that idea would have even got out of the starter's blocks. And I'm not suggesting that that's a good idea for everyone. That is something, as she began to individuate, that is something that welled up within her, and so we pursued that. So it's, we don't look for chaos, but chaos is going to find us often enough, and that provides us with our greatest growth opportunities. Okay, let's skip ahead. Let's skip that one. These are new species. Brand new species of flowers, brand new species of sea worm. Nature produces brand new stuff all the time. And this, folks, is the most exciting part of the mythology, this relationship mythology that I'm talking about. Because relationships are subject or appear to be subject to the same rules as biological evolution, if we consistently over time pour energy into our relationships, there is every reason to believe that brand new, miraculously creative stuff will emerge in exactly the way these new species have emerged. We're in a new environment, folks. This is all this, like, 50 years, 100 years is absolutely nothing on the evolutionary time scale. We are in circumstances, as far as our relationships are concerned, that are brand new, and brand new kinds of intimacy will evolve in general, and relationships are so complex that there will be brand new things, things within your marriage or your long-term relationship that you have never felt before. After 30, 40, 50 years together, there is every reason to believe that you can wake up one morning feeling that you can't, you're just blown away by the nature of the experience that you had the day before. As long as you continue to make the investment in the relationship. So that is my myth. That is what I believe to be true. And that belief motivates me to continue to do things that will try to create the conditions where that miracle can happen within my marriage and within my life. And as I said, the best scientific evidence we have with regard to relationships justifies this belief, and I'm open to being proven wrong. Go to the next one, please. Almost no one is foolish enough to imagine that he automatically deserves great success in any field of activity, yet almost everyone believes that he automatically deserves success in marriage. And that is true. We take these relationships for granted. If we do, we will probably lose them. That is the reality. The probability of losing a taken-for-granted relationship is far higher outside of Mormonism than inside. The probability inside Mormonism is that you will end up living in a dead relationship, a relationship that probably should have ended, because you're held together in circumstances where you're not motivated to try and invest the energy in the relationship that is required for that kind of growth to occur. Next. Now, there is a relationship model out there put out by some solid scholars that is pretty similar to what I just described. I found this after I came up with what I just told you. In quest of the mythical mate provides a four-stage process. There's the symbiotic stage where it's all about forming the relationship, losing yourself in each other. Then there's differentiation where you're kind of pushing the other away. You know, you're too close, you're smothering me, I need my freedom. And then there's practicing where you're kind of trying to figure this out. I mean, what, you know, why do we love each other and yet we're pushing each other away? What's this all about? Rapprochement is where you're reconciling yourselves to this new form. And then mutual interdependence, which really is just a different kind of symbiosis. It still is a symbiotic relationship, but with more independence within it. That is the possible outcome. Now, this doesn't happen once. It does happen at the beginning of most relationships, and if you think about your own, you can probably recognize those steps. It happens again every time there's a major change within a relationship, such as what would happen when one spouse or both spouses leave Mormonism. There's a wholesale reappraisal. Now, this process takes time. This isn't a honey. Snap out of it. Didn't you hear what I said? The Book of Mormon is a lie. Right? We're talking about roots that have grown around a tree. Tree roots that have grown around a rock. You take out the rock and the trees don't just suddenly assume a new shape. We're talking about neurons and connections between neurons that have to reform. They have to grow. We're talking about years, folks. And if we love our loved ones, we will try to create the conditions for that growth, and we will give them the time that they need. Next. Okay, back one. Okay, what makes people happy? Now, we're gonna skip a bunch of stuff in a moment, but we'll talk about this first. Most of us, all of us, as far as the research indicates, have a set happiness point. You're either kind of cheerful or you might be a little bit more morose. We have a range within which we can move our basic capacity for happiness. But it's not possible for everyone to become super cheerful. Now, ironically, the people who are a little bit depressed are also the most accurate observers of reality. The more accurately you perceive reality, the more likely it is that you are a mildly depressed person. Yeah. And that's not a bad thing. I mean, happiness is not the be-all, end-all, right? Being connected to reality, there's lots of things that are worthwhile other than happiness. Let's be clear about that. But anyway, your happiness is determined by your set point, the conditions of your life. Now, conditions are things that are kind of hard to change, like your race. That's hard to change. Like the fact that you live in a slum in India. That's hard to change. The fact that you are, you know, the child of a general authority living in Salt Lake City. Hard to change that. Some conditions can be changed, but they take a lot of effort. And then voluntary activities. There is a relationship between your set point, the conditions of your life, and your voluntary activities, and that determines how happy you are, basically. Next one. Intimate relationships are the most important condition. We never fully habituate to them, and we never fully habituate to being without them. So they are the key condition in this equation. Next. Oh, sorry, go back one. I'm just going to say one more thing about that last slide. Here's another. This realism stuff is really useful. My wife was really disturbed by the fact that we were not best friends. And the happiness literature, the research says that people are happier when they're with their friends. Friends are more interesting than spouses, frankly, in a lot of ways. Spouses, however, people get really depressed if they lose their spouse. Now, why is that? Well, friends satisfy the need for difference, the need for novelty. Spouses satisfy needs for stability, needs for comfort and a variety of other things. And there are times when your spouse is the most exciting person on the planet, but that's not all day, every day. The best holidays, where you've got your spouse and other family members and friends. Those are the best holidays. Holidays, by the way, usually depressing. There's a lot of literature on that too. Just Google it up. You go on a holiday, there's a predictable cycle. I laughed out loud when I read this. If you're not really busy on the weekend, guess what? You get depressed. That's the way it is. All right, so getting to know this literature and learning what to expect, what it's reasonable to expect, not just from your relationship, but from things in general, it's just wonderful. My wife was so relieved when she read this and found out that we weren't dysfunctional because I was not her best friend all day, every day. You know, I'm serious. It was a relief for her to have that knowledge. Next. Intimacy is multifaceted. We talked about that already. It's just such a complex relationship thing that it can evolve in so many different ways. That's why we never fully habituate to it. And that's why it's worth working very hard to preserve. There's limitless scope for new growth. Next. So happiness shouldn't be our only objective. It just tells part of the story. The elephant is all about feeling good. Like not about necessarily being happy, but the elephant is all about things that will satisfy immediate needs. Very short term in orientation. The rider is the one that's best. The rider is the one that has to often steer the elephant in the right direction to get to happiness. Next. Happiness isn't a compass. It doesn't tell you where you are or how good you are or anything like that. It's just a directional indicator. Are you moving in the right direction or not? Moving in the wrong direction. Moving in the right direction, you're probably happy. Moving in the wrong direction, you're a little bit sad. We get addicted to these, the stuff in our system, dopamine and whatnot, that relates to happiness. Now, we are going to skip way ahead right now. Let me just do that. We're going to skip all the way through I'll just cursor through it. That's the easiest way to do it. Is it okay there? Okay. So what we're going to talk about is falling in love now. And anybody who wants to read the rest of this stuff can. Whoops. Same-sex marriage is nothing new. We've been having the same sex for 25 years. That's in the section on habituation, what you get used to and what you don't. Here's the romantic versus passionate love. I'll just explain these real quick. So there's the 6 months at the beginning. Companionate love comes up in this very low curve. Here's what the same thing looks like over 50 years. You can't expect that much out of compassionate love. Companionate love is much different. Companionate love is more about shared experience. And some of the research in this regard that I find most interesting talks about our need to be known. That we eventually get over the need for approval. Relationships are formed largely on the basis of approval. My spouse pats me on the head and makes me feel good. My girlfriend pats me on the head and makes me feel good. She strokes my ego. We'll talk more about that later on. That fades in significance eventually. We still need to be patted on the head, but we need to be patted on the head with regard to all of the stuff that you don't show people right away, in spite of some of my characteristics that eventually become known. I still need to be affirmed and approved. And that's what that curve is. As you go through various experiences together, as you become willing to disclose more of your evolving self, it's not like the self starts out and is gradually disclosed. As new things come into being, your spouse, you want to disclose, she wants to disclose to you, and you affirm. And that is what, it's a very soft thing. It's the calm. If this here is the waves on the surface, this is the calm beneath the surface. And it takes a long time to come. Go ahead, next. Next, we're just going to skip through this stuff. Oh, back. Okay, love that windswept tree, right? Those of us who have been knocked around a little bit, we need to appreciate that. Next. This is a diamond willow. Diamond willows grow where I live. I used to carve them and help my Boy Scouts carve them when I was a scoutmaster. Next. Here's what they look like when they're carved. Next. Now, this is the tree dying as the result of a fungus or some other little bug that attacks the tree. The tree defends itself by trying to grow around the attacker. As long as there's white wood, the tree is still alive. But look at how many times this has been attacked in different places. Look at that sliver of white, right? Is that more interesting to you than a straight cane? Doesn't that tell an incredible story? I see myself a little bit in these diamond willows and in these windswept trees. We didn't ask to be born where and when we were. We just did what we did. And some of us come out of it really beaten up. If this was an ex-FLDS gathering, it'd be a different place. I feel grateful that I was not born in that community. But we've taken a few kickings, and that has changed us. I choose to see my experience in this way. I choose not to see this experience as having contaminated me, having ruined my life, and having ruined my prospects. There's lots of things that I could say about the positives that I derive from my Mormon experience. I'm not going to go into that. There's lots of negative things I can say, too. If I choose to focus on the negative, that will spill over into and poison much of the rest of my life. So after a period of time, a ferociously angry period of time, I have put that away, and that is a choice. And I'm not saying anybody else should. I'm not critical of anyone who emotes and is in that angry place. That is a phase we go through. But eventually, we need to get to the point where we can look at our battle scars, as my crazy teenage son does when he comes home from football practice. He's proud of these idiotic things that he's doing to his body right now. Next. Okay, pick a card. You didn't know that I have magic powers, apparently. Memorize your card. I'm going to make it disappear. Okay, next. Oh, not that way. Is that the second one? Yeah. Did I make your card disappear? Shut up. Some of you may have noticed that all of them are different. Most people don't notice that. This is one of, like, there are dozens and dozens of mental tricks that I've got in these notes. This is the only one we're going to stop at. This one relates to the fact that if we're not paying close attention to the specific thing that changes, we don't notice it. So most people will focus on their card, and they won't notice the precise identity of the rest. And so when all of those change, they won't notice. This is the magician's misdirection cue. Marketing people use it all the time. Mormonism uses it to a T. In another experiment, there's someone stops on a college campus with a map, pretends to be lost, comes up to a student, says, "Can you help me find my way?" This is a guy my size wearing a brown hat, let's say, right? And just as they're poring over the map, two other people walk by with a door, and rudely, like two workmen carrying a door, rudely elbow their way right between these people. And as they do that, a guy who's 5'6", not wearing a hat, takes my place. I step behind a bush. The other guy steps in, holding the map. The student virtually never notices. Doesn't notice the difference between a 6'3" guy wearing a hat and a 5'6" guy without a hat. Sometimes they switch races. People very seldom notice. They're focused on the map, right? You get someone focused enough on temple work, the celestial kingdom, genealogy. It doesn't matter what it is. You get them focused enough on one thing, and you can move the furniture around almost at will, and they won't notice it. Okay, so there's a ton of these consistent flaws in the way we perceive reality. It's really, really helpful when we deal with our relationships to understand some of those, and we're now just going to flip all the way, just keep going. Oh, cognitive dissonance, we won't talk about that. Falling in love, actually go back one more. There's a comic I want to get. There we go. We'll skip it. It's a good one. You can read it later. But I want the next slide. Marriage. My mother said it was simple to keep a man. You must be a maid in the living room, a cook in the kitchen, and a whore in the bedroom. I said that I'd hire the other two and take care of the bedroom bit. Wisdom from another philosopher named Jerry Hall. Next. Okay, Helen Fisher, one of the greatest researchers on love, how people fall in love, that sort of thing. She's published a whole bunch of stuff. We're going to skip to the next slide. This is drawn from her work. If you made a list with the reasons why a couple got married and another of why they divorced, you'd have a hell of a lot of overlap. That's true. There's so little difference between husbands, you may as well keep the first one. True, too. Next. Now, there is truth in both of those statements. So we seek friendships based on affirmation, and social groups are formed on that basis. Next. How do we signal our interest to a spouse? Well, mirroring, right? That's just a way of affirming. You sort of follow the same behavioral patterns while you're talking, body angles, that sort of thing. We laugh at the same jokes. We gossip about the same stuff. Next. You don't appreciate the nice things I do. Yesterday I burped, I love you in Morse code, and you didn't even thank me. See, he wasn't mirroring. If she had burped first, then that would have been good mirroring. But when you're taking a risk when you lead with a behavior like that. Next. So Fisher says that we've got four personality types: negotiators, directors, explorers, and builders. They tend to relate to each other in different ways. I'm not going to go through this, but there's a certain science to it that you're probably going to get along better as an intimate companion with certain types of people than with others. Next. Of course I can accept you for who you are. You're someone I need to change. Very common attitude. Now remember, we talked about the elephant. These elephants don't change a lot. They don't. I mean, get used to it. Get to know the elephant before you get married is the advice. Next. We're going to skip that and that and that. Yeah, next. Yeah, I've learned only that. Leave it there. Two things are necessary to keep one's wife happy. First, let her think she's having her own way, and second, let her have it. Next. That relates to husbands as well. Let's be fair here. We've talked about being known and affirmed. Next. Here's something interesting. Early in life, so infancy, adolescence, middle age, old age, earlier in life, it's really important to us in our friendships and our intimate relationships that we're connected with people who have information or other power factors that we need. Social assets. That's what we're looking for largely when we get married. Now, there's lots of other stuff, but your potential spouse has to score high on the social assets information list. Friendships, same way. You're looking for people who deliver things that you feel like you're interested in. Well, in fact, you're interested in them because they're useful. As you get older, that declines, right? And this becomes more important: emotional security, stability of the relationship. So if you ask a person who's adolescence, middle age, a person who's 35 or 40 in here to rate these things, and then ask them again 10 years later to rate these things, you may find that spouses who don't get along at all at age 40, at age 50 are getting along pretty well because their basic needs have declined. Also, men's testosterone goes down as they get older. That's a little secret that we don't really like to talk about, but it is true. Women don't lose testosterone, but their estrogen goes down. And so within the woman, the estrogen-testosterone balance moves toward the testosterone end of the spectrum, whereas in men it goes in the opposite direction. So very often, early in marriage, the man will be more dominant, and later in a long-term marriage, the woman will be more dominant. It's driven completely by chemistry. We may as well, you know, expect this stuff because it's coming along. Next. Back that. Not back, back up a bit. It's okay. One more. Forward, sorry. One more forward. It's my parents' anniversary and they're a little depressed. Their special song has just been turned into a laxative commercial. I mean, things change. That's the way it is. Next. 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 Oh, no, sorry, one back one. I'd invite you in, but my life's a mess. So this is a little bit about divorce. And, you know, we're going to skip that. We're going to skip right through divorce to post-Mormon marriage. I'll tell you when to stop. Since we're almost out of time here. Back. Okay. Marriages are tricky. People get divorced basically when their communications ratio falls below 5-1. And that's +5, -1, and that includes subconscious communication as measured by physiological stress responses and analyzing microexpressions on the face with a slowed down video camera. John Gottman has a 95% batting average when predicting divorce based on a 30-minute video interview of a married couple wired up in his lab so that he can detect the physiology as well as the micro expressions, slow it down, analyze the tape afterward. Within 7 years, he's got a 95% batting average of predicting which couples are going to get divorced. Now, these couples are completely unaware. He's measuring the elephant, right? The rider has no idea what's going on. He's measuring the elephant. And what happens is when you fall below 5-1, you don't stay at 4-1. You slide very quickly down to 1-1, and that's where divorce occurs. 1+ to 1- or below, that's divorce country. There's kind of like there's two valleys, right? There's the 5-1 valley over here and the 1-1 valley over here, and there's a ridge in between, but it's a very, very small ridge. If you get bumped out of the 5-1 valley, you're sliding down into the 1-1 valley. And couples who, there's different styles that couples have. Some communicate a lot more. Their relationships are more, you know, more volatile, but it's still 5-1. Other couples don't communicate very much at all at 5-1. Right? So lots of styles, but that's a constant, that 5-1. Now, in Mormon marriages, you know, we poor Mormons kind of had the deck stacked against us. We get married young. Remember the brain? That half-baked brain, right? The one that doesn't do long-term consequences very well? We get married quick. The commitment is often made within the first 6 months. Well, guess what? You're drunk. Right? You have no business making that kind of decision in that period of time. You have the kids right away. When does divorce usually occur, folks? Right? Within 2 years of having the kids. You have lots of kids, so they stay with you for a long time. You're encouraged to take different developmental trajectories. You're not encouraged to, you know, to build meaningful activities together. You're you know, date night and it's all around the church, family home evening, family prayer. You take that away. And my wife and I, another fellow said this to me earlier today, or yesterday I guess it was, said when we left the church, we had nothing. There was no basis for relationship other than the kids and occasional sex, very occasional after you leave Mormonism, right? And you've got all that hostility floating around. So, because of these factors I listed up here, maybe this is an unfair comment, but it's my observation that within the Mormon community, more than outside it, I run into people and I find myself wondering, gee, I wonder how they got together. You know, people who just don't look like they're, you know, they're connected. And it's because the initial decision is so often made poorly. We didn't have the opportunity or the encouragement to really get to know the person that we were going to marry. And so we misassess. Next slide. So when one spouse leaves Mormonism, the other spouse is going to be profoundly threatened. How's that 5-to-1 communication ratio going to look? Right? Use my example. So my wife was still a faithfully believing Mormon when I had this rupture in my life. So I'm leading her children away from the celestial kingdom. Yeah. Is that going to produce any fear in her if she really, really believes that the celestial kingdom exists? I am now a social pariah. Her friends have a visible fight or flight response when I walk into the room. Now, there's so many things, and she, try as she might, she's not going to be able to prevent herself from having those emotions come through. The studies have shown that we can fake the verbal, but we cannot suppress the subconscious, nonverbal communication, the micro flashes of expression that are registered on the other side. Elephant to elephant, they're communicating. The rider has no idea what's going on. Well, if our positive to negative ratio was 1-to-1, I'd be surprised. It was probably like 4 negative to 1 positive, or worse than that. And this is not uncommon. This is the common situation. So how do you deal with that, right? Now, and it wasn't just her to me, it was me to her. I was looking at her thinking, come on, I've told you, right? Read this book. Well, when you've got the adrenaline flowing, you're in flight or fight response, a good part of your brain shuts right down. And it's the rational part. You can't reason when you're under that influence. That book was toxic as far as she was concerned. She didn't read anything, to my knowledge, for a couple of years after I left Mormonism. Like, she was in a full state of panic. And how did I respond to that? It produced contempt in me. Why are you so weak? Just read the book. Think about it. Does that phrase irritate anybody else here? Think about it. Said in that tone of voice? Yeah. Okay. Whoops. Yeah. So on the spousal side of the equation, and often it goes, it could have just as easily have been a woman leaving and the man in the opposite situation. That happens frequently too. So the problem, the belief that has to be overcome in the Mormon person is the one true church belief. Any sacrifice required for entry into the celestial kingdom must be made. All influences that may take the family away from the celestial kingdom must be eliminated. That, if that belief cannot be overcome, the probability of the marriage lasting is extremely limited, because that will drive the subconscious communication, and it's just going to be extraordinarily difficult. Now, there's lots of precedent within Mormonism for a mythic approach to the idea of truth. Leonard Arrington, the only real historian who ever was the official church historian, that was his approach. You can find a lot of respected Mormons, some of them general authorities, although they wouldn't probably speak openly about this, who have that mythic truth approach. Now, I don't think it's a very good approach, but if that will save your marriage and act as a staging house perhaps to other things, I'm all for it. And let's talk about mythic truth and how the celestial kingdom might represent a lot of really good things. Mythic truth is really, really flexible. Really flexible. It's not like Mountain Meadows Massacre where something happened or didn't. Mythic truth is about symbols and ideas. Next. How do you get to 5-to-1? You're going to see that a few more times. That's the one thing I want you guys to remember. Key concepts. Emotional battleships always beat intellectual rowboats. Think about it. Just read this book, right? That is a rowboat, folks. You are fighting emotional battleships. The information is useless until the emotional doors have been opened. This is a slow biological process, but there are phase transitions. That's the state where the water's been heating up, heating up, heating up, heating up, and suddenly it boils. That's a phase transition. That happens in relationships and other aspects of sociology all the time, where it looks like things are not happening, and then one morning you're getting out of bed and your wife rolls over and says, I guess the Book of Mormon isn't true. What? Well, yeah, I was just reading an insider's view of Mormon origins last night. You were reading it? Yeah, it's not true. Man, right? Phase transition. Next. Emotional doors are opened by emotional forces. Now, from my side of the coin, or the non-believing person's side of the coin, if I can't empathize with my wife, how can I love her? Empathy comes about by understanding some of these mental foibles that we didn't talk about, but that are mentioned in the slides and are gone on, covered in great depth in the books that I've referenced. Once you understand the reality of the world of a believer, you can empathize. She's stuck. And here's my wife. She had 7 children, higher IQ than mine, has dedicated herself to the Mormon way. We go to business functions, and she says, yet again, one of these things is not like the others. The women that she's with are well-educated. They read financial and other newspapers. Julie is not. When she talks about the things that she does, these people try to be polite, but the subconscious communication is clear. It's like, wow, 7 children. Oh. How old were you when you got married? 19? Right? She's lost everything. She's terrified. The social capital that she had built up within Mormonism was very valuable there. It's almost worthless, at least or so it seems, outside. I had social capital in both camps. It was easier for me. There are lots and lots of ways to come to be able to empathize. When you can empathize, then you can love. You can really, really love. You can use desire. You can use fear. You can use authority. Let's go to the next slide. You got to talk to the elephant. Find ways to talk to the elephant. Let's look at that comic. I do so share my deepest emotions with you. Hungry and tired are my deepest emotions. another one says, how does that little poem go? If you love something, set it free. If it comes back to you, it was yours. If it doesn't, it never was yours. And if you find it sitting watching television, it means you've probably already married it. I think is the way it goes. Next. So get the right kind of help. Professional counseling really does help. Now, authority figures. Here's how you work with the elephant. You take all of the strategies that the Mormon Church used against us, and I've written a couple of essays that are on the internet about these things, about the confirmation bias and the reciprocity bias and the authority bias. These are all elephant traits. They're consistent flaws that makes Madison Avenue religions, network marketing organizations, and others consistently successful. Well, you can now employ those to help your relationship. So, authority figures. Richard Bushman wrote a book called Rough Stone Rolling, which is an awful apologetic tract in some ways, but it has a lot of information in it that your average Mormon is never going to find anywhere else, and it's been tacitly approved by the general authorities. They will read that book. Richard Bushman is an authority figure. Grant Palmer, kind of an authority figure. As far as I know, he's still a member of the church, passionately believes in Mormonism. Mike Quinn, as amazing as it is, still has a testimony of Joseph Smith in the Book of Mormon. So you can find authority figures who've produced information that is ingestible because they are authority figures that have some measure of credibility still within the Mormon community. My wife was helped immensely by a female Mormon historian now in her 70s who we met with for a full day. She just happens to be a friend of my mother. My mother thought that she would straighten me out and As it turns out, this woman was just in the closet. She was a non-believer who had not let anyone know. And I think that she may have saved our marriage. I think we might have gone off the rails during that first year if that woman had not both figuratively and literally embraced my wife and let her know that yes, these problems exist. They're real. Your husband's not overreacting. He's not gone crazy. And you should work with it. She was an authority figure. Next. So counseling, yoga, meditation, that's helpful. Next. Get to 5-1. Solutions, the reciprocity bias. So the reciprocity bias is great. If you're a marketing person, you know that you just have to hand away trinkets, give out trinkets. Many businesses have been successfully built on that basis. And when you give something away, people automatically feel an obligation to respond. And often they will respond with something much larger than what you gave them. If you're starting into a negative pattern with your spouse, and by the way, people who avoid divorce break negative patterns early. That's another consistent finding in the divorce literature. It starts and it gets nipped in the bud. Once it's gone for a while, much, much more difficult to nip it. Usually people either nip it in the bud with a gift or some humor and get back to positive, or it goes really negative and then there's avoidance for a while, some stonewalling and some not talking to you. One woman said that her husband was so irritating because she had to tell him when she was ignoring him. She could not talk to him for a week, and at the end of the week, she had to tell him that he'd been ignored for a week. Otherwise, he wouldn't notice. So, nipping it in the bud real quick, and gifts are great bud nippers. You've said something stupid, buying flowers, whatever, right? Or doing something kind. There's lots of ways to give gifts. They don't have to be objects. But that's pushing a button. I gave her something. She is probably going to want to give something back. Washing the car, go out for the night, hon. I'll take care of the kids, whatever. The social validation bias. This is huge. The research shows that the most consistent predictor of when people change religious belief is when they associate with, when their best, closest associates, 6 of them, have a different religious belief. And then they'll have some profound conversion experience. It's social physics. Your 6 best buddies are atheists. You moved from Georgia, where you were a Southern Baptist, to New York City, where there's no Southern Baptist congregation. You fell in with a bunch of atheists. Well, it's highly probable that in that situation, if you stay there long enough, you're going to change. That's just the way it is. So getting our spouses into contact with neat people, enjoyable people, people who you would be proud to associate with, who are not Mormon, is an absolutely crucial thing. I will skip through that. The notes that I'm going to put up have a lot of this stuff on it. Okay, now let's talk about Icarus. We're going to wrap this up now, real quick. So Icarus, what are the lessons that we can learn from Icarus? Next slide. Okay, stop. Okay, one more. There should be some text coming. Next. Okay. Proceed slowly. You've got new power and new freedom. Call in the pros. Call in the pros. I wish I had. Profoundly wish I had. Remember 5-1. That's the rule in marriage. As you exercise your new power, that's got to be a fundamental constraint. 5-1. And since your subconscious stuff is out of your view, you better make the conscious stuff well above 5-1. If you want to say something negative, store that up, baby, right? Earn that. Get a whole bunch of other stuff on the table. Back. This is a realistic motif, the soaring. I mean, the days just after I left Mormonism were among the most amazing of my life. But it's not always going to be that way. There are, we habituate, we acclimatize, but that sense of miraculous freedom is real. Next. I like this image better. And I like this one too. thank you to one of my friends for sending that to me, taken up at Park City. A lot better than that, right? Walk in the tightrope. A million things can go wrong. Any one of them can kill you. Sisyphus. Next slide. Back, I think we went a little bit too far. Okay, right there, rejection. Okay, one more. Next. Next. Are you going back or forward? Sorry, I meant to go forward. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. Back. Stop there. That's good. Okay. So what he lost is what we need. He lost intimate companionship, a connection to a social group, the right to choose his path in accordance with his strengths, to find flow. We didn't get to talk about flow. He's stuck in the desert of the same. He can't satisfy his need for novelty. All order, no chaos, no growth. Sisyphus is the anti-example. Camus and other great writers have tried to argue that Sisyphus represents us, that he represents the need to find meaning in a meaningless world. I reject that proposition. I find oodles of meaning in my world. I don't need God or the celestial kingdom to find meaning. I find meaning in watching my children grow. I find meaning in every goal I set, no matter how ridiculous it may seem to some people that I might want to do some things. If I set a goal, I find meaning in it. Next. Monty Python. I mean the Holy Grail. Okay, back one. It's okay. Next. Okay, one more. Okay. We are transformed by the journey. It's all about the journey, folks. I read that the people who overturned apartheid in South Africa became depressed shortly after apartheid. Now what? Right? They were euphoric, right? Within days, most of them were dealing with substantive depression because the journey was over. We are energized by the journey. We are so privileged where we live to be able to choose many journeys. We're engaged in many simultaneous journeys. Each of them provides the kind of satisfaction to us, the kind of restructuring. We can choose the journeys that will rework us in the image that we choose, the image that we desire, and that brings us full circle to the relationship concept. We need to choose the things that will bring us together, choose the environments in which we will want to be together, and pour energy into that activity together. And if we do that, there is every reason to believe that those miracles of creation will occur within our relationships. That is my fervent belief. Next. And so, here we have our man. Again, look at the serenity on that face. And look at that next drawer waiting to come out during the next phase of his evolution. Thank you very much.
Bob, would you be willing to stay for those who wanted to use part of their lunch hour to ask you questions and so forth? Okay. We are going to break for lunch, and I do have three or four very important, very short announcements. So those of you who would like to still dialogue with Bob, as we did last year, you're welcome to stay. I need to see Art Vanek and Bill Gardner up here by the AVA equipment. We've got a couple things to iron out for your presentations with the glitches that we've had here. If you could just come up here as soon as we dismiss, I'd appreciate that. Also, we have had several turn in their dinner tickets, finding out they couldn't come this evening, and those have been used, and we're really thankful for that. If anybody else has decided, for whatever reason, that they are not going to use their dinner ticket, please take it out and when you leave and give it to Diane out there on the table, because we can use them. excuse me. Out on the table also, you'll see some business cards. The Post-Mormon organization and the foundation got together and created these two-sided cards. Some of us have had the experience of running into people and having a chance to talk about Mormonism. Those of you living in Utah would use these certainly much more than some of the rest of us. But we have found that it's really nice to have a little business card that has the websites on them. We can just say, you know, if you want to know more, here's a couple of really good websites. So if you want to take some of those and carry them in your wallet or your purse, you're welcome to take them. That's why they're there. And I wanted to remind again, in room 219, Sam Michael is hosting just a lunch for those who would like to come, who would just like to have a very casual conversation about their life after Mormonism, if they have stayed involved in Christianity and what some of those experiences have been, and possibly, you know, some of the trauma that they've dealt with their families. Coming out of Mormonism, and she would welcome you to come. And we have determined that once you can go straight to the room, and we'll be able to order your lunch from there. So that's room 219. Our next session starts right at 2:00. We have a very full afternoon. We're very excited to hear from Art about the Book of Mormon stuff, and then the panel is after that, and the premiere of our DVD after that. So please be back on time. Thanks.